Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Good morning to you.
I was not here last week. There's a lot to talk about. I do want to just mention that I asked you if I could accompany you down to Norfolk, Virginia, as Mr. Jordan Sloan was honored at the Yeshivas Eish Kodesh dinner. You, of course, were the guest speaker. To see, and someone like myself who doesn't do much traveling as compared to someone like you, to see what goes on outside the New York area in regard to a flourishing yeshiva is pretty amazing. And the chizuk, the strength that you and people like you give when you visit and when you speak to them, I thought was amazing as well. Was this a typical experience for you to go out of town and see an institution that is thriving like this?
Well, I can't say that I speak at so many yeshiva dinners, although I do plenty of those as well. This is an unusual institution, and I think its track record in terms of taking boys that couldn't find their way in some yeshivas or previously, and the warmth and the unique way they have of approaching the students and building ties to them really was reflected there, and the support of the community, because you had people from all walks of life, including many non-Jews who are business associates and others,
right,
who came to the dinner.
Sometimes unique for out of town, huh?
Well, it's perhaps less unique out of town than it is in New York.
Right, good point. Unique for us, I should say, in reference to what goes on out of town. And the other thing I wanted to mention, and no reason to go into depth in this, especially with all the news to cover, but I did see, as I mentioned to you, I saw the movie Follow Me, the Yoni Netanyahu story. I think it's an amazing tale and documentary of great Jewish heroism and the struggle that young Jewish leaders have. You are one who encourages Jewish leadership, especially among the young people. I know it frustrates you when you see potential among people and they don't use it for these types of purposes. So I don't know if you want to do the same, but I am going to highly recommend the movie to everybody.
I don't know that it's everybody's taste, but I think that it certainly communicates his story. It's not about Entebbe. For those who think this is an Entebbe movie, this is about Yoni, his leadership, and is very honest and frank about his the challenges, personal challenges that he faced, and the issues that he confronted. It is certainly moving when I saw it, and in subsequent showings where I've heard others' reaction to it, it seemed to move people very much.
Yeah, no question about it. All right, a lot going on this week. It's been a while since we've spoken, and I'm never quite sure where to begin. But in this case, we're going to begin with the Egyptian elections, because that's one of the news stories that's dominating the headlines. Now, I guess you would have to say no surprise here, because you've been warning us for months about the role of the Muslim Brotherhood in all this. It looks like there will be a runoff between the quote-unquote Mubarak candidate, who was most recently prime minister, and a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood. Does that look like the way we're heading in Egypt?
That's the way it would appear. While the polls showed Amri Musa, the former foreign minister and head of the Arab League, in the lead up until the most recent days, and Fatou, who was an alternative candidate, as well as and the secularist Shakib, who was the former minister, prime minister under Mubarak, who was showing very strongly in recent weeks the indications. But if you notice, most of the claims that Morsi is ahead are coming from the Muslim Brotherhood. The Al Jazeera sort of substantiated it, but there's not going to be an announcement until next week. I mean, we're not going to know who the two finalists, and then there will be a runoff between them, because if a candidate doesn't get a majority, as in many countries, you go to a runoff, and that is almost undoubtedly what's going to happen. I don't think that Morsi will get more than 50% of the vote. But the counting is still going on, and nobody knows exactly what the outcome will be. There were some 51 million people eligible to vote. The turnout on the second day was much lighter than what many people had predicted. And they did do some exit polling, and the results are only released after the polls closed. But I think that the trend certainly seems to be that the Muslim Brotherhood pull their act together, because this was a substitute candidate after the courts had ruled out their initial candidate.
The turnout was strong or not?
It was very strong the first day. It was less so the second day. But we don't know the exact numbers yet. We'll know once the counting is complete.
Because what I'm getting at, is there any way to tell, or is there any way to determine if there's a difference in the attitude of Egyptian citizens, Egyptian voters? Does anything that happened this week tell us that they lean more Democratic or want real change, or unfortunately are heading in the direction of the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, to too far of an extent? Like, was there anything we learned from the electorate this week?
Well, we learned a lot, but not from the polling so much as from the polls that were done of the Egyptian
right.
people, where 85% said they opposed normalization with Israel, and most said they wanted a worsening of relations, even to the category of hatred that was offered as an option. But 90% believe that peace is better than war, and that the treaty with Israel was the right choice, which I think shows the dichotomy of views and the complexity of the situation that we face in Egypt, where while they don't want war and they want to have a peaceful, they support the peace with Israel, they hate Israel. And they don't most supported cutting off the oil trade. And in fact, now Egypt is going to sue Israel for all the oil that was sold between 67 and 77, taken by Israel when it controlled the Sinai. And they're suing for $480 billion in an international court. So the polls, though, consistently show these trends in our world. When the recent polling about their concern for the Palestinians is very, very low. Their concern about Iran, very high, and even favoring military action against Iran. So, and more than 50% in 21 countries, in fact, in those polls, show that they supported military action.
Is it as obvious as a non-expert like myself would think that Iran and Syria, for instance, are happy with the direction Egypt's going in, and Jordan and Saudi Arabia would not be happy, or is it more complicated than that?
No, it's much more complicated because of the nature of the relationships, even with the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood rejects Iran. Don't forget there's a Sunni-Shiite split. There's also, and we see that issue coming to the fore more and more in the fighting in Syria, where you have divisions within the opposition, which we could talk about. So the efforts both by Turkey and Iran to exploit this, Turkey was told to go home. We had 400 years of Ottoman rule. We know what it's like. We're not looking for it. And the Iranians have repeatedly tried to overthrow the Mubarak regime, are hated by the Egyptians, the Egyptian people, and have not been able really to exploit it. Now the question is, to what degree do other elements, like in Jordan, you have the Islamic Jihad groups, in Syria, Al-Qaeda, you have Al-Qaeda in the Sinai, you have Al-Qaeda in other countries, what degree will any of these be able to take the situation and exploit it and begin to build a base? If they see the continued corruption, then people will say the Muslim Brotherhood is just like everybody else. If they see the economic situation doesn't improve as the Muslim Brotherhood promised that they would, they will start to dismiss them as they do other parties. There was some backlash to the Muslim Brotherhood already, and the fear that them controlling all of the elements of government, and the ones leading that were in fact the Salafists, who are the more extreme Muslim Brotherhood group.
And in regard to Turkey, I'm confused. Who's telling Turkey stay out of it?
I said when they tried to come to Egypt, when Erdogan tried to step into the void in Egypt, the Egyptian government and the Egyptian people, but most of all the Muslim Brotherhood, told him to go home.
And Turkey is upset that Israel is establishing closer ties with countries like Cyprus?
Turkey is apoplectic about anything that happens because of the Greek-Turkish conflict. They issued yesterday 4 warrants against Israeli officers who were involved in the Mavi Marmura, which they continue to exploit and use to rally people against Israel inside Turkey, even though trade between Turkey and Israel has increased remarkably over the past year. and significantly, which shows that the people want to do business with Israel. They have taken a step like issuing these warrants. There is a report that Israel offered $6 million compensation to the families of those who were killed in the Mavi Marmora. As you know, the Turks are demanding a public apology and all sorts of conciliatory moves, which Israel, many in Israel, oppose strongly, including the prime minister. People want to see better relations with Turkey. Turkey, as you know, had very close relations in recent years, very recent, mm-hmm. with Syria. Before that, a tense relationship. Now that has obviously deteriorated, and the relationship with Iran has deteriorated. So they're looking into the region also and don't find a strong ally. So whether the question is whether this Islamist regime in Turkey really wants to have better relations with Israel, the role that it wants to play in the region to improve its relations with the United States, it can put on some sham improvement, or will they really take serious steps to improve the relationship? There are signs pointing both ways. Turkey is getting much more involved in the Syrian situation. They are training Syrian opposition forces in Istanbul. We're seeing shipments of AK-47 rifles and other equipment to the rebel forces in Syria, to the opposition, mostly funded, I think, by the Gulf countries and Saudi Arabia. When they made that announcement that they would send funding and the tune of many millions every month, I think that's when you see the shipments of weapons, because the Turks are being paid for it. But Turkey is getting more and more involved in that situation and is concerned about what the ramifications could be.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Let's go to Iran and other places, but through Washington this time. You were in Washington this week, and it seems from at least the media reports that I saw that you were given a lot of assurances. You were reassured by the vice president and other staff at the White House regarding Iran and other situations. Did you come away from the White House with greater confidence that the United States is handling the Iranian situation well?
Well, it's true that everyone from the vice president and the National Security Council, the acting Secretary of State, and others who addressed us, all of them obviously addressed the issue of Iran, though not exclusively. And I don't think that they were offering us overly optimistic assessments. Everybody made clear that nobody knows what the outcome of the current talks, the talks that took place in Baghdad this week, and seemed to be inconclusive, if anything. And another date has been chosen, I think it's January 18th and 19th, to meet in Moscow. But at the same time, that they noted that some of the findings, you know, there's now new evidence, both of the fact that they have increased the number of centrifuges operating, and that since February, perhaps 350 or more machines have been put into force, in addition to the 700 that were there, all of which means that they can expedite, they can enrich more and faster. There's evidence, supposedly, that the enrichment elements were found, which indicated a much higher level of enrichment than had been previously thought. So Iran is an incredible dilemma for everybody. First, they try to bring the Russians and the Chinese along, so that automatically waters it down. The Iranians are going to try and string this along as much as possible. If you remember in 2003, in November 2004, they had the negotiation with European 3, and each time they hammered out an agreement, each time they reneged on the commitments that they undertook to cooperate fully with the IEA. That is exactly what they've been doing all along. Rouhani, who was the chief negotiator, went to the Majlis, the parliament in Iran, and he just completely laid out how they use this to the time to use it for enrichment, building centrifuges, doing all the other things.
Well, this week's meeting was also postponed, essentially.
It took much longer than anticipated. It was supposed to be one day. It was 2 days.
No, but I'm saying the meeting took place, but the decision-making has been postponed.
There was no decision, and the fact is that is also a decision. The fact that they're going means that the Iranians did not comply. And the Iranians are complaining that the West didn't listen to their proposal. Their proposal was a non-starter. They want a recognition of their right to enrich to whatever level. The West had been talking about allowing them 3.5 or 5% enrichment. Any enrichment would be a huge mistake when it comes to the Iranians. And the Senate this week reacted to that, and you saw the very tough sanctions that they passed unanimously by a voice vote that would include all sorts of new penalties on Iran, especially about business sector, energy sector, and companies that do business even outside the United States, American companies who have subsidiaries there doing business. I mean, very strong statement on their part, but the demands have to be clear, and what we're seeing is not only a diminution in terms of the demands, but they talk about it in phases. They talk about, you know, giving gestures to the Iranians. The one big gesture would be that they would allow the insurance sanction, meaning that not to insure the ships that would go to the Far East primarily, would be postponed. They would not postpone the European sanctions due to go in effect on July 1st, which cuts off all the imports to Europe, which is a big deal for the Iranians. And we saw the apologists, even those in this country, like Trita Parsi of the Washington, the National Iranian American Council, where he says they both entered with maximalist positions and neither budged, but the hard work now begins. I mean, all the same arguments and things that we heard before, trying to justify what is in fact a hardline position by Iran, looking to exploit the talks, gain time. They've already gained months, because they're going to move quickly into that, quote, zone of immunity.
What else was on the Washington agenda? What else was discussed in that meeting?
In the meeting in Baghdad?
Well, no, the meeting that you were in with the vice president.
Oh, we talked about many issues. I mean, there are, unfortunately, a lot of things that are going on regarding Israel's security, obviously about the turmoil.
How did Washington react to you face-to-face in regard to Bibi's big coalition?
Well, they think it presents good opportunities. They obviously stress the fact that the U.S.-Israel relationship is very strong, especially in the military and security sectors. They talk about the extensive consultations that are ongoing between the United States and Israel during the Baghdad talks. They said that they are in regular, frequent contact every day, and the chief negotiator flew from Baghdad to Israel today to brief the Israelis on the talks that took place. They all spoke about the understanding of Israel's position and that Israel needs to do what it has to do to protect itself. But obviously everybody's hoping that they will give time to this process. That's why the window of immunity that I just mentioned is so important,
right?
Because for Israel, the window closes earlier than the United States.
Did you read the Time Magazine King Bibi article?
I did not.
You know, Malcolm, something that you mentioned a few times when I saw you on Sunday, which you said this publicly and privately, and it's so important. You know, last night, I mean, look, I'm sure we have in our audience people who are supporting the Democratic candidate for president and those who are supporting the Republican candidate for president. But it is very hard to come up with a case where the Republican can win if you look at the electoral map very carefully. It's certainly the president's election to lose coming up in November. And the reason I mentioned this is because you kept stressing, again, publicly and privately, that the Senate and the United States House of Representatives might prove to be even more important elections than the presidential election in terms of the future of having friends in Washington. And I think that we need to suspend a minute on convincing people that there's a lot of attention being paid, and for good reason, to the presidential election, whatever side you're on. But people have to make sure that they utilize their resources and their efforts for the quote-unquote smaller races as well.
Exactly, and I said that that the Jewish community can often have more leverage and more input because of our numbers overall and the percentage of the population. That, you know, they used to say that God gave oil to the Arabs and the Electoral College to the Jews. But with the dissipation of Jewish populations, with the shifting demographics in the United States, that is increasingly less so. But the congressional races can make a huge difference. And I just cited the congressional action on Iran,
right,
which is so important. And when you get a unanimous vote, and it does reflect where the American people are, that they want tough action on Iran. They want, like the people in the region, they want transparency. They want to see the military implications stop. They want to take all the steps that are necessary. So my point, first of all, I do not agree that this election is predetermined.
It's certainly the president's election to lose.
That's what many assess it to be. But I think that the polling, national polling, is certainly very close.
last night he had 259 electoral votes. We're still 6 months away from the election. He was already at 259.
Well, that's part of the problem, is that people are going to be so sick and tired of this. And I have people who call me during the day to say, did you see the changes in the polls? And I tell them, every time somebody sneezes, a poll is going to change.
The only way, according to what I saw last night, the only way Romney can win is if he wins states that don't even exist. I mean, every toss-up state he's got to take.
Well, I don't know. This is a strange election year.
Yeah, I know. A lot can change.
Things change. But again, I want to go back to the point that you're making, which is very important. When the sanctions emanated from Congress, so much of the leadership on the security relationship emanates from the Defense Department, but also gets the support of Congress for the Iron Dome, for other things. And we have a lot of changes this year because of retirement, because of reapportionment.
And you could list, we're losing a lot of friends.
We lose friends, we lose opposition, it happens. And thank God the new members coming in, though they have less experience, they're not people who lived through the Holocaust, for instance, as did the previous generation of members of Congress. And many of them even were liberators or fought in the Army at the time and saw firsthand. For them, for the members now, Israel always existed. They don't, right. Many of them were born after the Six-Day War. So the whole historical context is very different for them. But what we're seeing is that the concern with which they approach these issues and the openness, and you will have a different constituency, you will have different communities represented, and we have to work much harder in order to reach out to educate those who, for whom Israel is not the priority, maybe a priority, or it may not be a priority at all. And there was reports this week that Iran has 450 missiles capable of hitting Israel. But they also talk about what Iran is doing in a country like Bolivia. I stressed here for a long time that Iran has its sights on South America as a base of operation. Of course, starting with Venezuela and Cuba, but spreading. And there's this organization, I think it's called ALBA, which is the Association of Bolivarian Revolutionary States, which Iran is it's an observer there. Mm-hmm. But this week people were focusing on the developments in Bolivia, where Iran's influence has increased so much. It set up a regional defense school for this ALBA's group's military people, and it's Iran that's funding it. And they have 300 trainees there, trainers, from the IRGC, the Iran Revolutionary Guard, in Bolivia. And they get strategic resources, including for their nuclear program, from there. They add this to the list of countries like El Salvador and Ecuador and others that they have also been able to seduce. And I think that people looking at this know that Congress can play an important role as well in addressing some of these concerns.
A lot of work to be done out there. Jumping around, but there are a couple of issues I want to make sure to get to. A piece of clay was found during archaeological excavations at the City of David in Jerusalem, bearing the name of the city of Bethlehem in ancient Hebrew script. The piece of clay dates back to the First Temple period, making it the first tangible evidence of existence of the city of Bethlehem in ancient times. I'm just curious about this before I ask you about the story in general. There are people who suspect that the Archaeological Society, or whatever the official name is in Israel, always saves this material in advance of a Jewish holiday or some other time where people may be paying closer attention or feeling the nostalgia of being a member of the Jewish people. So do we find out about these discoveries right when they're made or not?
People are so suspicious.
have they been holding this for a couple of months or not? And you're very close with the people in charge, so you'd be able to give an honest answer.
And first of all, there's the Israel Antiquities Authority, but this was a discovery at the City Gate excavations, which are part of the Ir David, the City of David excavations, which I hope everybody has gone to see after our talking about it because of the immense number of amazing discoveries. But this one is another one of really historic importance. And and especially because it comes before Shavuos, where the history of Beit Lechem, of Bethlehem, in the lives of Ruth and Naomi, etc., and later on, of course, King David himself. So you have this seal, which was likely, they say, on something that the ruler or a king in Bethlehem sent to the ruler in Jerusalem, and maybe to King David.
Right.
And it is the first time outside of the Bible where we've actually seen the word Bethlehem, the name Bethlehem, designating the city. And there were many people who questioned whether it really existed then, because there was no archaeological proof, let's say, where the name has appeared, like we've seen Jerusalem, the name in many, many places in archaeological discoveries. So here you have something found on the floor, this little seal, but it's very clear, and it clearly says Bethlehem on it. So this is another amazing discovery proving the history of the Jewish people, the biblical accounts. Substantiates it. It's something people should look up and talk to your kids about over Shabbos and Shavuos. You want them to believe you're going to sit and study Torah. You want to show them how the validity, the proof, it's right there in the most concrete form possible.
And we have the perfect opportunity with the Megillah to discuss this specific finding.
Exactly.
And I shouldn't concentrate on the timing of these announcements, right?
I do not think so.
On the Tal Law thing, so I keep reading about how the religious parties are not going to cooperate with the new government regarding the revisions that we are expecting, whatever they may be, in the Tal Law in Israel. But I thought one of the whole points of the aftermath of the coalition, this new coalition, was that the religious parties don't have to be consulted in order to establish revised rules for the Tal Law. Am I right or wrong?
Well, it has to is the key part of what you said. Look, they're the ones most directly affected. The whole society is affected, but they're the ones most immediately impacted. And obviously, in enacting a law, you don't want to have a major cleavage or split in the society. And this, because of the emotional aspects of it and the significance that religious and others that is attached to it by both sides, though, for and against, you want to try and work out an understanding that or the most people can live with. You won't find something that everyone can live with because people approach this in very absolutist terms. They say, you know, you can't have any draft of yeshivas. Secular people have called for a volunteer army. I mean, those things are not going to happen. So the question is, how do you take the current situation, rationalize it, make it acceptable to the largest number of people possible, understanding that the reasons why this law was passed in the first place, why the feeling that there is a lot of abuse of it, and why it's necessary to continue some elements in order to protect Limud HaTorah, people learning and people and seeing that as a value, and at the same time assuring the security of the country.
By the way, an article in from Arut Sheva today that Haredi enlistment continues to rise in the Army.
Steadily, and Nachal Haredi and other things, other units like it. And there's a lot of talk about how they will create units that will be sensitive to the needs of religious soldiers. I would say that there were times in the past when that wasn't the case, but overall, you know, the whole army, in terms of all of the other aspects of making life possible. But it is difficult. There was no doubt about it. But part of the problem also getting a lot of the people who do not work the opportunity to work, which military service certainly expedites, or to find alternative service that people could do as well. There are national service programs that many religious women now participate in. There's talk about having people be teachers, working in communities, do other things for 2 years so that everybody contributes to the country and takes part of the burden of the society and not just reaps the benefits.
Understood. Malcolm, what could you tell us about the effort to keep certain organizations out of the Celebrate Israel parade? I know you're not directly involved with the parades. I'm not asking you to comment from that standpoint officially, but just as an observer, it seems that there are those who claim that certain organizations are really very vocal when it comes to being anti-Israel or sometimes anti the policies of the State of Israel. Should they be included?
Well, this is a very fundamental question about the inclusiveness. I do think, and I've argued often, that there have to be standards for what the community tolerates, and I think that while we have to recognize the diversity of views in the community, there also have to be standards. You know, I was in a debate recently at the Jerusalem Post Conference, about whether when academics who are in Israeli institutions, everybody recognizes academic freedom and you want to see the spirited exchanges on a campus, but I believe that there have to be some standards, that those who call for a boycott of institutions, those who take certain steps, can be held to account. The Salute to Israel parade should be a unifying event. We should try to get people there, but I don't know anybody arguing that Nuturikarta should march. They stand on the side, they harangue the people marching, but nobody is arguing that they be participants. I've not been involved in it and have not really followed it closely, but I think this is that's the core of the discussion, and it, obviously people feel very strongly about some groups who support directly or indirectly some of the activities like boycott or similar things.
Right. I guess that's the time to stress Jewish unity when we're about to enter the holiday where we had the greatest Jewish unity in our history.
That's exactly right. By the way, one of the things this week that came up that is of concern is in Yemen, the killing of a man who was a leader of the community. He was in a market in Sana'a. It reminds, and I've talked before about the instability in Yemen, which the media tends to overlook, but Mr. Zidani was killed. He was, I think, 50 years old, and it's it's a very sad and tragic development, and his body was brought to Israel for Kvura. But there's a small remnant of the community. There were those who urged people to stay behind. I think those people have to do a lot of soul searching. That these people should all be out of Yemen. The situation there is deteriorating with Al Qaeda. Massive killings. You saw they attacked one day, 95 soldiers killed. Then they killed 23 members of Al Qaeda in the south. The situation there is getting worse and worse. And I think overall in the Middle East, you know, the revolution that we've seen this year is still going on. People who think that we're past that initial phase, we aren't. This is not phase two of the Arab turmoil. This is still phase one, where the direction is unclear, certainly Syria, other countries. But there are many foreign troops, for instance, in Syria, and they're coming from Tunisia. Now, people think that things have settled down in Tunisia, when in fact we see that the Islamists there and what is happening is very different than the impression that is often created, as well in Libya, where you have anything but, I think, stability emerging right now. And the same is true, by the way, in Lebanon, where we're seeing efforts by Iran to use the banking system there to bypass the sanctions. They have many branches, most of which service Hezbollah. But there were killings this week in Beirut. It was the unrest in Syria was spreading there. And there were attacks both in Beirut and elsewhere as a result of it. So two of the countries that are out of focus and are not considered part of it are also being impacted by this instability, which is spreading and compounded by the unrest that we see and the turmoil in Europe, which has broad ramifications both for the Middle East and, of course, for the United States.
What percentage of the countries that experience what the media refers to as the Arab Spring have had free elections to this point?
Well, there were elections in all the countries in North Africa, in Libya.
Tunisia had?
Tunisia, absolutely. And the Muslim Brotherhood won every single election.
And look where it's going in Egypt as well, right?
And in Egypt. Now, I think in Egypt you do have some backlash to it. There is more concern. But on the other hand, you know, the polling that is done, like often here, you know, and other countries, they always used to say that Israelis tell the truth to the pollsters and then lie at the polls because the outcome is always different than what the pollsters predict.
Right.
And the answer is that they don't poll proportionate to population. They don't go into, I guess, rural areas where the Muslim Brotherhood has its greatest appeal and see what the proportion of turnout will be and what the sentiment is, whether it's dealing with corruption, which a lot of people oppose, but more than that, it's about jobs. There are, unemployment is huge. The economy, the economic conditions are not improving. And all we're doing is setting the stage for more radicalization. We see the emergence of groups like JN in Syria today, with ties to groups inside Israel and to other radical groups, Islamic Jihad groups, the growth of Al-Qaeda presence in many places. They exploit these situations, and certainly Iran looks to exploit every one of these situations for its own purposes and to export its extremist ideology.
I can't let you go without my one of my favorite quotes from Yoni Netanyahu. You ready?
I'm ready.
Oh, it just struck me. This is a quote about Philadelphia. Maybe that's why you had certain things.
Well, we have that bond.
Malcolm is a Philadelphia boy. Maybe he doesn't like what
he didn't go to the Yeshiva Philadelphia.
Maybe he doesn't like what Yoni said about Philly, because this is what he writes at the age of 16 when he was so regretful.
I'm with W.C. Fields when it comes to Philadelphia. People have to look that up to get it.
Yeah, well, the younger generation has to. I'm ashamed to say I know exactly what you mean. So he comes to Philly, 16 years old, a devastated high school youth who can't believe he had to leave Israel in order to fulfill his father's mission to continue his academics and research in Pennsylvania. And he writes as follows: "All this space that surrounds me leaves me without any air to breathe. I yearn for a place that's narrow, hot, rotten, filthy, a place that's mostly desert, and that one could scarcely find in a map of the world. The only things people talk about are cars and girls. I think Freud would have found very fertile soil here. My school has about 1,500 students who don't know what they're doing there. It looks more like the Tel Aviv Sheraton than a school. My house is terribly nice, surrounded by lawns and trees and empty, meaningless life." What a perspective, huh?
Yeah, and what a loss that his death at Entebbe, something that was mourned by people across the political spectrum. He was admired by people across the spectrum. I think the comment he made, if he was looking what he was describing, he could have found in the Philadelphia area, but I don't want to get Governor Christie mad, so I won't say where. But he was brilliant in so many respects. And his intellectual level was really highly respected by everyone. And I met people who knew him when he was in school in Philadelphia. I didn't know him there, obviously, but he was really such a tremendous talent. As much as his life was conflicted and had many different strains, and people will see that in the film, about his personal struggles and balancing his immense commitment.
Well, it's the old Jewish leadership problem, you know.
It's a problem that everybody who is committed, truly committed,
right,
faces.
No question.
When you have to balance all of the demands of life, and it's something others take for granted, and everybody can be critical until they put themselves in those shoes, and then all of a sudden they find that it's a lot more difficult than they thought and a lot more complex, as is the world today.
Yeah.
You know, people look at it with simplicity, and I think one of the values of what our discussion even today is to show people that things are not what they look, that you can read a paper, you can hear a news report, and you can even see it, whether on television or other ways, and it's not true what you're seeing. The distortions, the lies, especially when it comes to Israel, every week, I mean, I could spend half the show just talking about all the distortions and misrepresentations each week about Israel. And people have to learn to dig beneath the surface, that they have to take the time to do it and to understand that things are far more complex than often it seems, and that simplistic solutions are usually easy, as Dorothy Parker once said, obvious and wrong.
Right. My apologies to Rabbi Yudin, because I'm way over schedule. I just got to make one other point, though, because the Jewish Week has a major succession article on page one about Jewish organizations. In fact, your reference there as well. And I say this because, again, in light of the film and other things, we're always looking for the next generation of Jewish leadership, and we're encouraging people to take on these roles. And I am sure you spend half your days paying careful attention to young people that you see who have the qualities that are needed.
I absolutely do. Today I'm meeting with two young people who are recommended that we want to try and find ways. I don't have the staff and infrastructure that many other organizations that can accommodate. But I try personally to do it because we have to walk the walk and not just talk the talk, which means spending the time with young people to bring them along. And when there are unusually talented young people who are committed, and there are many, thank God, then we have to nurture them.
Yeah. Well, we have the holiday of accepting the Torah as we renew our commitment
and
to the one
unity.
To the one above, we should renew our commitment to Jewish leadership as well and doing what we need to do in whatever role we have. Thank you, Malcolm.
That's the definition of Jewish leadership.
Have a wonderful Yontif, and we'll speak next week.
The
there he is, Malcolm Honlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.